afternoon, or perhaps evening, Clara. And welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Right Up Your Algae. It's been some time since our last episode, Clara, that we are recording here today.
No shit, Sherlock.
we've missed some pretty special holidays.
Of course we have.
We didn't take a moment to celebrate Black History Month, or National Day for Women in STEM, and most importantly, much more important than those last two I just mentioned, Groundhog Day, of course.
Oh my god, Emily. She's kidding.
I'm kidding. Lucy the Lobster told us 6 more weeks of winter. Who could have guessed?
She lied.
I think it's time for the boil up.
Yeah. I do too.
But today we're going to be talking about a maybe lesser known celebration, if you can call it that, rather an anniversary. This winter marks the 100th year anniversary of the Nome, Alaska diphtheria epidemic, which has had ripples in the cultural sphere, scientific sphere, and has fundamentally affected how we treat outbreaks today. More than other sciences, like physics and chemistry, biology and environmental science are very closely tied to its relationship with people. Specifically, at least in Canada, many biology and environmental science classes try to include Indigenous relationships, traditional knowledge, and how ecological management impacts Indigenous people. Because, of course, at least here in Canada, this is their land we live on, and they typically rely on the land to a much higher degree. First and foremost about this episode, not all of my sources are necessarily peer-reviewed. Where we are dealing with an event from so long ago, some parts are a bit up for debate. This story is often called The Race for Life, and has been told time and time again through movies and books, and has gotten a bit of a reputation, almost an association with children, which is kind of interesting. And I think it's because, largely, it's a story that has dogs in it. And because this is a story that has dogs in it and has this childish association, I think maybe the less heroic parts of it and the more maybe gruesome or the kind of things we don't like to talk about kind of get glossed over. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to tell this story through a new lens that kind of really sheds light on how things like epidemics have affected Indigenous groups. So let's get into some background. We are traveling to Nome, Alaska, a remote northern community just 2 degrees south of the Arctic Circle. 1920s Nome was a gold mining town at the tail end of the gold rush and the Spanish influenza, which impacted the town just 7 years prior, in 1918. There were 3 Inuit groups that lived in the area prior to and during American colonization. The Inupiaq, Central Yupik, and Siberian Yupik occupied the area, and although each have distinct practices, they often came together and shared traditions, such as ivory carving, sewing, drumming, and more. The Alaskan natives during this time were sharing the area with white Americans and established some semblance of a positive relationship, with trade in between them most often being art, skin, clothes, and aid in traveling outside of the village. However, they were far from being regarded as equals by white Americans. Nome was racially segregated, but interestingly, there were Christian churches specifically for Alaskan natives that white residents would also attend. So, like, the white residents had their own church that they would go to, but they would also go to the native church. Establishing the abhorrent racism experienced by the Alaskan natives, Jones, 2017, examined the local newspapers in Nome between 1898 and 1934, and noted such phrases that were used to describe Alaskan natives by the white Americans. And I'm not going to list most of these. Some of them included, like, gibberish speaking. Just, like, total nonsense to describe. Obviously, they're not speaking English. You just showed up here. But it just exemplifies, like, an extremely racist time period we're talking about here.
Yeah, like, I can't imagine going somewhere and being like, oh, these people don't speak English. I brought the smallpox, but that's okay. You don't speak English.
In January 1925, Dr. Curtis Welch was the sole doctor servicing Nome, Alaska, who first recognized diphtheria in Inuit children. Diphtheria is generally an acute, communicable respiratory infection caused by toxigenic C. ulceranis and C. pseudotuberculosis strains. Diphtheria is characterized by a pseudomembrane often located in the throat. Other more severe symptoms associated with fatality include systemic effects, such as myocarditis and neuropathy.
So, pretty bad, right?
Yeah, pretty bad. Astute observations, as always, Clara.
Thank you.
Astute observations. The transition from the 19th to 20th century brought many breakthroughs in the treatment of diphtheria, such as the development of the short-lived, but still significant, diphtheria antitoxin, or DAT.
That.
I'm glad you're keeping this one light, Clara.
It is a very heavy topic.
It's a heavy topic. Keep it airy. DAT was a very important step in the development of the, what we now use today, diphtheria vaccine. Public health advisories in the United States in 1925 brought forth many conversations that are still being had in the 21st century regarding resistance to receive treatment for easily curable ailments. 100 years ago, we're still talking about this today. Public health advisory in 1925 in the state of Illinois stated that ignorance and carelessness from parents causes child mortality due to diphtheria.
Of course.
What a sentiment. 100 years ago. And now there's measles in friggin' Arizona or something. Like, parental reluctance to immunize their children to diphtheria is particularly problematic considering children under 5 in unimmune populations make up a majority of fatalities from diphtheria, earning it the nickname the Angel Strangler. Heading back to Dr. Welch. Contact was quickly made with the manufacturers of DAT, or DAT, and urgency was established in finding serum that could be transported to Nome. This sparked a total media frenzy at the time and was intensely followed. There were a lot of, I read passages from a couple different books and stuff, and it would often talk about, like, people literally, like, waiting at, like, the radio, and people would gather. They wanted to know what was going to happen next, and,
oh my God,
like, waiting for updates.
Imagine
kind
if
of
they
thing.
Had social media.
Yeah, the Twitter feed would have gone nuts.
The X feed, you mean?
Oh, pardon me. God forbid. 300,000 units of serum were located in a back room of a storehouse in the Alaska Railroad Hospital in Anchorage by Dr. John Bradley Beeson. But they needed to find a way to get this to Nome. Now, Nome, Alaska in the winter of 1925 had many factors contributing to its inaccessibility. The Bering Sea was completely frozen, and at the time, aircrafts available in Alaska were open cockpit models, so, like, no top.
You wouldn't catch me dead at one of those things.
Anyways, ship and plane travel were not on the table for transporting the DAT. By train, the antitoxin could get from Anchorage to Nenana, but there was still a 674-mile distance between Nenana and Nome.
What is that in kilometers?
Almost 1,000? Or maybe it's 1,000? See, this is American, so a lot of it is in miles. This 674-mile journey was the typical mail route for Nome in the winter.
I found it. It's 1,084.69786.
Okay. So 1,084-kilometer journey. This was the typical mail route in the winter, and usually it took 33 days, with the record at the time, before all of this had occurred, being 9 days. But Nome did not have 9 days, and it certainly didn't have 33. Dr. Welch ordered a quarantine and kept children at home and limited adult movement to necessities. The trek could not start until the train arrived in Nenana, and 21 mushers were chosen to make the journey. The most experienced rider, Sepala, a Norwegian dog sled champion, was tasked with the largest and most dangerous leg. Many drivers used Malamutes, but Sepala preferred smaller and faster Siberian huskies, which he attributed to his success as a musher. On January 27th, at 9 p.m., the first musher, Wild Bill Shannon...
Oh my gosh.
I wish I had a nickname like that.
Me too.
Wild Bill Shannon received the package of DAT. These were then wrapped in quilts and skins to keep from freezing and breaking as he set out on the first leg of what is now known as the Serum Run for Life. Bill Shannon and his dogs had a rough go of things, to say the least. Temperatures in interior Alaska were at a 20-year low due to a high-pressure system from the Arctic. Temperatures were negative 46 degrees Celsius. Can you even imagine?
Are you sure it was Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Oh, no. This is Celsius. Which is almost the same as Fahrenheit because they sort of, like, equal out at, like, negative 42 or something, I think.
Oh, my gosh. That's so cold.
So very, very cold. With 40 kilometer per hour winds and very few daylight hours, because this is winter in the Arctic,
oh God.
So they traveled mostly in the dark. Shannon used unexperienced dogs and was forced to use sea ice to travel due to a portion of the trail being destroyed. He stopped for 4 hours to rest in Minto at 3 a.m. and had to drop 3 dogs, which tragically perished.
Why would you use unexperienced dogs?
There are a couple things that happen, which is really unfortunate that that ended up... I don't know why. This is, like, the most important thing they've ever done, you know?
And maybe that's the reason why he's got his nickname Wild Bill Shannon.
He was just because taking any old dogs.
Yeah,
because... He was riding with pugs.
Yeah. Get some shitties and pugs.
He had a golden retriever on there. He didn't know what he was doing.
R.I.P. to those 3 dogs.
Yes, of course. Rest in peace. Shannon arrived at the next stop. He didn't get off scot-free here. He arrived at the next stop with frostbite turning his face black when he transferred over to Edgar Calland on the 28th. Calland's route was not much easier, and his hands actually froze to the handlebar, and he had to pour boiling water over them to get them off. I mean, this could have been while he was wearing gloves. His hands may have frozen to the gloves. On this day, there were no new cases of diphtheria. The next day, however, saw 2 new cases. During this time, efforts were made to bring more antitoxin to Nome following the serum run. So this was just preliminary, you know, get the vulnerable people, the antitoxin, and then we're going to send more over when the weather gets better. On January 30th, there were now 5 children dead. Various drivers transported serum for the coming days, and additional drivers were intended to assist Sepala for the most dangerous leg that was up and coming, but communications did not make its way to Sepala, and he did not wait for assistance at the designated stop. By January 30th, there were 27 cases, and this was when Sepala had a decision to make. So he is now coming from Nome, trying to find his location that he's gonna grab the antitoxin. So he doesn't have it yet, but he's trying to find the guy who has it right now. So he had a decision to make: cross the ice on the Norton Sound or take the longer but safer inland route to meet Gongnengim, an Inuit musher who had the serum. Sepal, of course, takes the shortcut successfully, and before making it to the meeting location, actually sees a musher waving in the distance. He approaches it and sees it is Gongnengim, and his dogs were tangled up in a caribou.
Oh my gosh.
So it was sort of just dumb luck that he occurs on him totally outside of the meeting location. He takes the serum, and he hears from Gongnengim, from the fellow musher, the state of Nome. He himself has a young daughter, it's his only child living there, and decides, he's like, okay, this is serious, we've got 5 children dead now. He's like, I've got to take the shortcut back. He's like, I'm going to go back over the Norton Sound that I just passed, and this time it would not go so smoothly. So while he was crossing the ice on the Sound, the ice broke around Sepala and his dogs, and they floated out to sea for 9 hours. And he sort of was, like, doing a perimeter, trying to find, like, areas where he could move onto other portions of the ice and get back onto land. There was one moment when a portion of the ice floe he had found had a 5-foot gap between itself and a larger portion of ice that attached to land. So Sepala decided, he was like, this is the best I'm gonna get, you know, we're gonna make this leap. So he hurled his lead dog, Togo, across the gap. He hurls the dog across with, like, the plan that he will now pull the other dogs until they have enough room. They will jump over, they'll get the sled. But Togo's got a job to do, you know? Unfortunately, when he throws the dog, the line snaps. So he's just, dog's just over there, not completely unattached. And the book I got this information from has a great passage at this point where it totally switches gears and talks about why Togo might have done what he does next. It says how Togo was bred with pulling as an instinct ingrained into him, how he was trained intensely by Sepala, how he viewed being reunited with Sepala and his team as a reward. Regardless of why Togo did what he did, Sepala reported that this is what happens next. Togo dives into the water after the lead and struggled back out onto the opposite ice pan. He rolls over the lead so it wraps around his body twice and pulls the sled far enough that Sepala could get the sled and the rest of the dogs over the gap.
Oh my gosh.
The following days would be less dangerous but more strenuous for the dogs, so they're climbing elevation at this point. Sepala was then able to pass on the serum to Charles Olson, who passed the serum on to Gunnar Kassan, the final driver. Kassan arrived February 3rd, and all 300,000 units were still effective, and the epidemic was able to get under control. Over the 5 days starting January 27th, 20 mushers, 150 malamutes, huskies, wolfhounds, and mutts were used in transporting the diphtheria antitoxin to Nome. So like I talked about earlier, there were dogs that did perish in this journey, and some of it did seem like it was not entirely just because this was a necessary, you know, we needed to save these children. Some of it was due to neglect, it seems. And it's unfortunate that it was that way. So one of the mushers actually had forgotten to give his dogs rabbit skin coverings. So typically they would put rabbit skin coverings on, like, their bellies. Because yeah. Their bellies, like, aren't kind of as fuzzy, maybe, as they're not as much fur. One of them had totally forgotten, and his dogs had perished because he had forgotten to put the rabbit skin coverings on them.
And that's something we talked about in our sweating episode, too. Like, that's where they lose the most heat.
Yeah, so very unfortunate. You know, this was a heroic event, no doubt, but, like, there's a tragedy involved as well. Like we said earlier, a part of why this has kind of had this children association, you know, we have the statue outside the Children's Museum in New York. There's books, there's movies. It's because there's dogs, of course. So Kassan, the final driver, and Balto, as well as Sepala and Togo, but mostly Balto, received a lot of fame and recognition. Like I mentioned, Balto had a statue in his honor, animated movies, his own series of children's books, and Sepala, at the time, was really saddened that Togo didn't get the same recognition. While this is true, many of the original media coverage attributed Togo's actions to Balto. I don't really care. there's been like Times Magazine articles like dedicated to it. They're like, this injustice to not giving credit to the dogs. And to me, the dogs don't care.
I remember hearing, because Balto was accredited to all this stuff, mm-hmm. he actually got worse treatment in the end.
It's true, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so both dogs ended up doing, like, North American tours, but Sepala was personally with Togo for most of the tour, whereas Balto was kind of got this sideshow treatment and was a bit more, to my knowledge, probably endured a bit of, you know, not great treatment.
Yeah.
While, yes, Togo also was a part of that, like, sideshow situation as well, Sepala was, like, totally, I think Sepala actually raised Balto and Togo. He raised all of his dogs. He was, like, extremely involved and actually, like, founded this award for sled dog, for mushers who gave the best treatment to their team. Mm-hmm. So, like, obviously was very, very much cared for his dogs having good treatment, and none of his dogs had passed away, despite having the worst leg of the race.
And you'd be shocked that Togo didn't die after jumping in the water.
Yeah, after jumping in the Norton Sound, of course, the Bering Sea.
Yeah, in the middle of winter.
So yeah, there's been a bit of this conversation, if you know this story, as well as, you know, maybe someone who grew up watching the movies or what have you. You might have known about this sort of lost recognition, but I think that the true lost recognition is that none of the Alaska Native mushers got much recognition at all, despite their involvement and covering 2/3 of the distance compared to white mushers.
Yeah.
Much of how the diphtheria epidemic impacted Alaska Native communities was undocumented. However, this was not true for the Spanish flu, which happened just a few years prior. Of 90% of the white Nome residents who contracted the Spanish flu, it was fatal for 30 residents. Of the 250 Alaska Natives who lived within the town, only 50 survived. And in its vicinity, it's estimated that 1,000 Alaskan Natives died. This has been largely tied to the difficulty Alaskan Natives have had to accessing medical care, both at the time and still today. Mm-hmm. And while Dr. Welch did treat Alaskan Natives, we can kind of assume that they would have been second to white residents. And Dr. Welch estimated that over 100 infections occurred amongst out-of-town Natives during the diphtheria epidemic, but it would have been impossible to know how many passed away because they did not report their deaths. Despite the efforts of Dr. Welch and his team of nurses, the outbreak resulted in 22 confirmed cases, 20 suspected instances, and 5 confirmed deaths before the serum was successfully transported to Nome. Regardless, this is regarded as a human-animal success story, and one journalist at the time critiqued that it wasn't much of an epidemic, as if the deaths of 5 white children and an undocumented number of Inuit children is not newsworthy enough. The only notes that Dr. Welch officially made about how diphtheria impacted local Indigenous people is that they were hit harder than the American patients due to their lack of immunity. But we're going to go back to the dogs for a moment here. Both Togo and Balto were taxidermied, and one study I found actually did genetic testing on Balto and found that sled dogs of 100 years ago were largely much healthier than sled dogs of those today, due to decades of inbreeding in our modern dogs.
No shit.
Yeah, I mean, we maybe could have guessed that. Maybe we could have guessed that.
Yeah. It's nice to have some science to back it up, but yeah. I think we knew that too.
Nowadays, the Serum Run for Life is immortalized in the Iditarod, which is an annual dog sled race that runs a similar trek to the Serum Run. This is an extremely controversial race, and I couldn't find sources that were agreeing on the amount of dogs that have died in the race, but it seems that number is incredibly hard to come by. They keep that, like, tight. But we do know that roughly half of the dogs that start the race seem to have to stop. They aren't able to get to the end, not because they've died, but because they run into, like, exhaustion or frostbite to some degree. And there was a recent year, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, that 3 dogs in just one race had passed away.
I remember listening to, I think it was an episode of Tooth and Claw, when they talked about the Iditarod, and it was a moose attack?
Oh, yes, there was...
Attack of a moose? Like,
I think it was a woman who was training for the Iditarod, and then she was attacked by a moose. And I don't think she ended up doing the Iditarod. Or maybe she tried, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways.
Anyways. Not
important.
Everything after this is just opinion, and I want to put out there, I don't necessarily have qualms with working dogs working. I think under good treatment, of course, dogs can have a very fulfilling life being a working dog. They're usually bred to do these things. They're often, like, most stimulated doing something that
take
is...
Take a Border Collie, for instance.
Yeah!
Like, they're a working dog.
They're a working dog.
They're not an apartment dog.
No. No, of course not.
That is my strong opinion.
And I'm not against people using sled dogs. Absolutely not. It can be a totally ethical choice. But the Iditarod specifically is an extreme sport. And dogs can't choose to run, say, an ultra marathon in the snow. You know, a person can make that choice. They can say, I want to put myself in harm's way for an extreme sport, but a dog can't do that.
Yeah.
So it does feel a little bit icky. And I've seen even groups that are not necessarily, that are specifically pro-sled dog, anti-Iditarod. So just the race itself is just a controversial version of a regular sled dog competition. Arctic Native people have a long history of using dogs for hunting and travel, and Canadian settlers have used this relationship to persecute Indigenous people. So this was, of course, largely an American story, but I think we do need to talk about the Canadian context of Arctic people who use these dogs as a lifestyle choice and as a part of their culture. So in the 1950s, thousands of Inuit sled dogs were slaughtered by the RCMP in Inuit settlements. This led to food insecurity, economic insecurity, removing their independence, and causing generations of trauma still felt today. In 2006, the RCMP launched an internal investigation and found themselves cleared of wrongdoing.
Really?
I am shocked. Inuit leaders said killing the dogs kept nomadic people from living their traditional lifestyles and was another form of cultural genocide, similar to residential schools. At the end of 2024, $45 million Canadian was committed in reparations for specifically these killings of sled dogs. And it was like 6 years after the official apology.
Well, the thing that I don't understand is that's like, if you put it in today's context of us, right? Just living here. That's like taking away all your cars, taking away...
If you loved your car, you know?
obviously there's a different context, but just like trying to put it in our mindset, that's like taking away every mode of transportation that you have. Like taking away your right to go to the grocery store, basically, is the same kind of thing that like I would think of as that. Except, of course, there's another context of love and companionship with these sled dogs. But that's like taking away your basic, basically everything that you need to survive, you're just taking it away from people. Mm-hmm. So RCMP, do better.
Yeah, their justification for why they were cleared of wrongdoing was because they were removing a threat to safety.
That's a lie.
As if like hunting dogs, you know, they're like...
Yeah, they're just racist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alaska Native people, still 100 years later, experience adversity in healthcare. Alaska Native people disproportionately experience infectious diseases compared to the general American population. Singleton et al. In 2009 proposed that a long overdue mass immunization efforts are imperative in preventing further death to remediable ailments in Alaska Native communities. Like Dr. Welch said, they have less immunity to diseases.
Yeah.
So this, of course, ended on a bit of a sad note, but I think we can lighten up the tone a bit if we do a...
I've been waiting for this.
And we actually have an abundance of good news coming from Noah.
Yay.
Two new babies have been spotted.
Oh my god!
First-time mom, nicknamed Accordion, was seen with a baby, as well as another first-time mom, nicknamed Cashew, was seen with a baby, making them the 8th and 9th first-time moms of this last calving season.
Oh my
so there's
god.
Actually two more babies born than we originally thought.
Yay! Go, mommies.
To give even more good news, three whales were spotted entangled in 2024, have since been spotted gear-free in 2025.
Oh my gosh, yay!
One, Chiminea, was seen off of Nantucket in December with two buoys on her mouth. And it was, like, super worrisome. It was, like, dragging her mouth behind her, you know, not good news. But has since been seen spotted happy as a clam with no fishing gear to be seen off of the coast of Virginia.
Let's go.
Yeah, a total win in the right whale community.
Total wins.
Congratulations,
mommies.
Yes, congrats. We'll be at the baby shower. No, wait, they're already here. The
first birthday party.
Yeah. Let's move on to our favorite segment,
trivia.
Now, Clara, let's see if you were paying attention. What percentage of the Serum Run for Life was completed by Alaskan Native mushers?
66.666666666.
Just about that much. Which musher had the longest journey?
Sepla.
Yes, Sepla. What breed of dog was Togo? Although, this breed looks a lot different today.
Siberian Husky.
Exactly. He was a Siberian Husky.
So cute.
Thank you so much for listening
Wait,
today.
Wait, no. Oh! I have a dirty birdie.
You have a dirty bird?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Dirty bird.
Tell me all about it.
Okay. So, I'm going to give you some hints and some little things to help you guess. The name for this animal, there's like four common animals that have the same kind of common name when they're being referred to. They're named after the sound that they make, and they're a species in Africa. They weigh only 2 to 6 kilograms and can sprint up to 40 kilometers an hour.
What on earth? Oh, you gotta give me more than that.
Okay.
Can you make the sound that they make?
No, because that's the name.
Okay.
Okay.
Is it fluffy?
No. Okay. So I'll give you a little bit more.
Okay.
They are an antelope in the genus Matacoa.
A gazelle.
No.
What sound would an antelope make?
It's an onomatopoeia.
Moo.
No, do you want me to tell you?
Yes, tell me. What is this dirty bird?
It's the African dik-dik. And there's four types. There's four subspecies. The Gunther's dik-dik, Kirk's dik-dik, Silver dik-diks, Salt's dik-diks.
Oh. Oh, I love the dik-diks.
And they're very tiny. They're like only 30 to 40 centimeters.
Really small. Or sorry, it's at least average. I swear.
It's average.
It's average.
It's average.
That's an average size antelope, I think. maybe even too large an antelope.
Above average?
And we hope this episode was right up your alley.